And a good Wednesday morning to you. Welcome into the Nick Craig Show, streaming live this morning on YouTube, Rumble, and X. Don't forget that you can take the show with you 24/7 on demand by checking out the Nick Craig Show in your favorite podcast app. You can also listen online by visiting the website nickcraig.com. Thanks for spending some time with us this Wednesday morning. We've got a busy show for you as we continue to track everything ongoing locally, statewide, and at the federal level. Our show this morning is brought to you in part by The Law Group. Visit them online at lawgroupnc.com or give them a call at 910-251-6088. So since the early days of the second Trump administration, the administration that he took and was sworn into in the latter parts of January, we have seen a consistent trend with the vast majority of the things that the president has tried to do, right? I'm specifically talking about his executive orders. The president has a problem with something. He wants to change something. He signs an executive order to do so. And what happens immediately? We talked to Seth Woodall about this last week. You've got these Democrat activist groups, ACLU, all of these Soros-backed groups that just immediately find whatever the president's doing, take his executive order, shop it around the country to what they believe and what is accurately described as left-wing district court judges, and those judges decide seemingly immediately that what the president's doing is unconstitutional or illegal. They put a temporary stay on his order, and it's done. Now, it's not permanently done, but in the sense of the long, drawn-out legal process that we have here in the United States, there is this temporary stay, and the president and the administration's option is to slowly walk this through the court system. That is what we have seen with dozens of the president's executive orders since he took power in the latter parts of January of this year. And to the left's credit, I will give the devil his due, at least with this, they've been very successful in doing this. Now, back a couple of weeks ago, the United States Supreme Court ruled in a case that seemingly opens the door for these federal district court judges to no longer have the ability to essentially legislate from the bench, because that's what we're talking about. Now, I am all in favor of and a strong proponent of the rule of law. I am somebody that believes that the law should be followed, like many of you are. And so if the president or any other elected government official is acting in an illegal manner, then I would in fact want that stopped, because I'm somebody, unlike the left, who believes in the rule of law, not just when it's convenient for me, but believes in the rule of law. But the fact and what we have seen over the last few months is that's not what's happening. Judges are not blocking Trump's executive orders, whether we're talking about deportation, we're talking about this morning a major decision from the Supreme Court yesterday on the size of the federal bureaucracy. They're not deciding this case on whether it's legal or not. They are deciding these cases on whether they, the district court judge, likes the policy that has been set forth by the president. And those are two distinctly different situations. Saying something is unconstitutional, saying something illegal, is one thing. Saying that you politically disagree with something, saying that you don't like that the president is doing something, is a completely different discussion. Now, I believe on the left, they think that those two things are synonymous, that thinking it's illegal and just disagreeing with it politically are the same thing. So that's why they have been, to a large part, very successful in using these left-wing activist district court judges to block policies that they disagree with. Now, if Democrats cared so much about their policies, then I would argue that they should have done a better job trying to put forth a better presidential candidate in the November election last year. If Democrats are so hell-bent on making sure that their agenda and their policies are not only protected but move forward, I would contend that they should have tried harder to win. They maybe should have held an actual primary process to figure out what Democrat voters and what American voters would have liked in their presidential candidate. See, they decided for political expediency that they were not going to do any of that. They decided that it was more important to just prop up the, at the time, sitting vice president of the United States and Kamala Harris and just admonish any of the process. Now, of course, the irony in all of this is the party of screaming about democracy and protecting democracy and Trump is destroying the democracy. I'll note, as I have done for years, we don't live in a traditional democracy. We live in a democratic republic. But nevertheless, this is the left who completely admonish their democratic democracy process in picking their presidential candidate to shoehorn in the vice president. Right? That's what they decided to do. Another example of the incredible amount of hypocrisy on the political left, which is no shock and no surprise to you. So we turn to a decision from the United States Supreme Court yesterday. The Supreme Court on July the 8th lifted a lower court order that prevented the Trump administration from carrying out job cuts in mass and restructuring federal agencies. You'll remember in the early days of the Trump administration, he spoke on and actually campaigned on this as well, but spoke on and then signed an executive order in early February attempting to cut down on the size, scope, and scale of the federal government. This bloated entity that's, for the vast majority, sits up in Washington, D.C., sucks in a bunch of taxpayer dollars, and for the most part, doesn't really provide a good return on investment. There's not really a lot of ROI with the vast majority of these employees within the federal government. It has turned into, and many folks have described it this way, as the federal government is just an employment camp. I mean, at this point in time, that's what the federal government does. Yes, of course, they've got their agencies and their regulatory bodies and so on and so forth, but they've just turned into this vast employment network. And while many people are making a good living and making a lot of money working for the federal government, that's not a good thing. Private business, private enterprise should be providing and employing individuals, not the federal government. Now, I'm not some weird anarchist libertarian type that says, oh, just completely get rid of the federal government. That is not what I am a fan of, and that's not what I'm advocating for. But just because I want some level of government doesn't mean that I want this bureaucratic, out-of-control entity that is now the government. You can still be a government. You can still function as a government without having hundreds of thousands of employees, many of whom are, as we have learned over the last couple of years, working second full-time jobs while they're so-called working, which I'll throw in air quotes, for the federal government. Because many of these people are, or were in the past at least, working from home. They'd been home since COVID. They purchased some $15 dongle on Amazon that's called a mouse clicker that keeps their mouse active on their computer so their little green light on Microsoft Teams stays on all day, and they don't have anything to do. They're just sitting there collecting a paycheck, and in other cases, are working a second full-time remote job while they're collecting not only a federal government salary, but all of the benefits associated with working for the federal government. There are well-documented cases of that. We have heard from individuals that are in those positions that have been that have spoken to the news and have come forward. We know it's an issue. If the federal government wants to be the government, which I am in favor of, then they need to trim out all of the fat, find individuals that are actually willing and capable of working, hire those individuals, and do the job of the government. Plain and simple. I'm not saying get rid of everything. I'm not saying fire everybody. But it needs to, the standard needs to be set very clear. If we are paying you to work 40 hours a week, then you need to have 40 hours a week worth of work. If you don't have that work, then we don't need you as an employee. Right? We look at the difference between government and private business. The vast majority, not all, There are plenty of cushy corporate jobs, middle management jobs, where people don't do a whole hell of a lot of anything. But for the vast majority of small and medium-sized business, if an employee is not working, not because of their own fault, but there's nothing for them to do, then the vast majority of the time, those individuals are let go. It's not because they're a bad employee. It's not because they're not doing their job. It's because there's no need for them. And in small and medium-sized business, the bottom line is very important, because there's, unlike the federal government, there's no unlimited amounts of money to fund it. Small and medium-sized business, many of them work on very small and very tight margins. There's not cash galore flowing in 24/7. So when you've got an employee that doesn't have any work to do, you're probably going to let them go or figure out a different position for them within the company so that they have a job. Right? No small or medium-sized business wants to pay an employee $40,000, $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 a year to do nothing. That's not sustainable. That's not practical, especially in a small company. And there is no reason that the federal government, state government, or local governments can't operate in the same manner. You should still have your employees. You should still have your departments. But if individuals are not tracking what they're doing, if individuals are able to work another 40-hour a week full-time job while they're allegedly working for the federal government, I think it is a fair thing to say and a fair assessment to draw that you no longer need to employ that person. If you have enough free time at your job that you can work another 20 to 30 hours a week for somebody else while you're allegedly working for the federal government, that is a problem. You don't need that employee if there is nothing for them to do. Again, how private business handles it versus how the federal, state, and local government handles this. And of course, you know, this has been a big discussion locally over the last couple of weeks as we've watched the budget debate take place and officially go forward in New Hanover County. There's going to be about 100 positions that are going to be slashed from the county government. Is it because those employees are no good? No. Is it because that they're gaming or scamming the system? No. But there is a real practicality of only a limited amount of money and figuring out where that money needs to be spent. And you may not be able to have 15 people in one department. Maybe you're only going to have 13 or 12. The government, the entity and the organization can still operate with 12. It might be nice to have 15, but you don't need it. And it comes back to the old adage of need versus want, which is something that government struggles with in an incredibly, incredibly miserable fashion. They just don't do it. And anytime you force them or try and encourage that as an idea, you have to listen to those on the political left talk about how you're ripping lives away from individuals because you need to look at needs versus wants. You're destroying people's lives because they're no longer employed. That sucks. But that's what happens in every other business minus the government. So back to this decision. This new ruling yesterday from the Supreme Court lifts U.S. District Judge Susan Ilston's May 22nd order that temporarily stopped large-scale layoffs known as reduction in force from moving forward while the litigation continues in the lower courts. The president signed this executive order in early February. It was blocked in the latter parts of May and has been on hold since then. The case is Trump versus the American Federation of Government Employees. They said that they plan to recognize, the American Federation of Government Employees has said the planned reorganization of the federal government will lead to hundreds of thousands of federal employees losing their jobs. And so I hear that statement. I read that statement in the story. I read the press release from this government employees group. And I think to myself, if hundreds of thousands of federal employees are going to lose their jobs, will the government stop operating? I think to myself, if this is to go to fruition, which I don't know that it's going to be hundreds of thousands, but maybe it is. If this is to go forward, will core government services just stop operating? My gut reaction to that is no, they will not, because many of these employees that they're talking about, I might argue the vast majority of them, are not truly necessary for the continued operation of government. And so I hear the call, I see the quote, and my gut reaction is, okay, but can the government still operate? If the answer is yes, then I'm okay with those individuals losing their positions. Not because I think they're bad people, not because I'm in the business like the left of life ruination and destroying people's lives, but we have a serious problem in our country with a bloated federal government, and it's something that needs to be handled. That's the long and short of the story. The Supreme Court said in an unsigned order that the district court blocked the government's actions based on a lower court's view that President Donald Trump's executive order, which was 14-210, and the memorandum issued by the Office of Management and Budget were, quote, unlawful. The executive order dated February the 11th was created to implement the Workforce Optimization Initiative of the Trump administration's Department of Government Efficiency. The order directed all agency heads to work with DOGE to reduce staffing and limit hiring. The court expressed by saying, because the government is likely to succeed on its argument that the executive order and memorandum are lawful, and because the other factors bearing on whether to grant a stay are satisfied, we grant the application. That was the decision from the United States Supreme Court. Now, they didn't actually rule on the case, right? See, this is the difference. The Supreme Court didn't, and I just read their quote from the majority opinion. They didn't say that this is said and done. They said because the government is likely to succeed, which is how many of these temporary stays and other temporary injunctions play out, because that is likely to be the case, because the Supreme Court looks at this executive order and goes, well, yeah, there's nothing illegal about the president trying to reduce the size of the federal government. This is why they decided and made their decision. The court added that it expressed no view on the legality of any agency reduction in force and reorganization plan produced or approved pursuant to the executive order and memorandum. Now, as you can imagine, the Democrats on the United States Supreme Court were not happy with this. Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson dissented from the new order, which she called, quote, not only truly unfortunate, but also hubristic and senseless. Senseless. Okay. Jackson said that there was no basis to conclude that the district court erred in its findings that the president is attempting to fundamentally restructure the federal government. She wrote, lower court judges have their fingers on the pulse of what is happening on the ground and are indispensable and are indisputably in the best position to determine the relevant facts, including those that underlie fair assessment on the merits, harm, and equities. Merit, harm, and equities there from Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson. Now, she says that these lower courts are, you know, they've got their pulse on it. They're on the ground. They're best positioned to determine the relevant facts. As I was reading this yesterday afternoon, I was thinking back to what I opened the show with this morning. All of these left-wing district court judges just deciding for seemingly absolutely no reason other than the fact that they disagree with the policies from this administration, that this is no good, that we don't want this, that this is bad, and as Democrats, we disagree with it. That's how the vast majority of these rulings have been made. Yet she makes the claim that these judges are in the best position to determine relevant facts. I completely disagree with that synopsis there from Justice Brown Jackson. It's insane. These judges have determined that they no longer want to play by the rule of law and they want to play politics, which is a serious problem. But because the left was unsuccessful in winning the election last November, they have decided it is more politically expedient to now use the court system to try and do their bidding than actually convincing American voters that they have the best solutions, the best ideas, and the best policies to move America forward. They have failed to do that, so they now want to use the legal system as their last line of defense. Sue Till Blue is alive and well within the Democrat Party. Justice Sonia Sotomayor said that she concurred with the Supreme Court's order, even though she shared some of Jackson's comments. Now, this is pretty interesting. As you know, Sonia Sotomayor, no friend of Republicans, no friend of President Donald Trump, actually signed on. This was an 8-1 decision by the state's highest courts. She wrote, "Although the president cannot restructure federal agencies in a manner inconsistent with congressional mandates, Executive Order 14210 requires agencies to, quote, to plan reorganizations and reductions in force consistent with applicable law." And the memorandum reiterates as much. So at least Sonia Sotomayor, now I don't know that this is a long-term change for her, because normally she's pretty far out there with Justice Brown Jackson. But this decision and her siding on with the majority in this court is a good sign, I think. And as it's explained right in the executive order, the president himself is not going into federal agencies with a chainsaw, with a buzzsaw, and cutting everybody's jobs and cutting everybody out. No, that's not the case. The executive order calls for agency heads to restructure. Now, I will make the argument, I know those on the left will disagree, but I would make the argument that an agency head, for example, Lee Zeldin at EPA, I would argue that Lee Zeldin has the authority to determine who is working at EPA. I think, and I am of a strong belief, that Lee Zeldin, the head of the Environmental Protection Agency, has the right and has the authority to restructure his agency as he sees fit. At the end of the day, he's running it. It's his agency. Those plans are not before the Supreme Court, so it's not in a position to assess whether they will be carried out in a lawful manner, Sonia Sotomayor said. I join the court stay because it leaves the district court free to consider those questions in the first instance. In the government's application filed with the United States Supreme Court, Solicitor General John Sawyer said that the district court's nationwide injunction barred nearly the entire executive branch, all 19 agencies, including 11 cabinet departments, from implementing an executive order that directs agencies to prepare plans to execute lawful reductions in the size of the federal workforce. The injunction is based on the indefensible premise that the president must secure explicit statutory authorization from Congress to exercise his core Article 2 of the Constitution authority to superintend the internal personnel decisions of the executive branch. That's according to the Solicitor General. The district court's order violates these bedrock policies and other well-established doctrines. The American Federation of Government Employees said in a brief that the district court needed an adequate time to consider the Trump administration's, quote, breakneck reorganization of the federal government, which included looking at the legal issues surrounding the many programs in the federal government that will, quote, be abolished. The government union gave examples of how many employees will be fired at certain agencies as a result of these reduction in force efforts. The Department of Veteran Affairs plans to end 80,000 positions, which according to them would, quote, severely hinder veterans' access to health care and other benefits. The Department of Energy and the General Service Administrations have both intended to fire about half of their workforce, and the Department of Health and Human Services plans to cut at least 10,000 positions. The Department of the Treasury plans to eliminate 40% of their positions at the IRS, while the Small Business Administration is on track to reduce its workforce by 43%, according to the brief. If the Supreme Court grants the Trump administration's application and the courts later find that the president, quote, overstepped his authority, there will be no way to go back in time to restore those agencies' functions and services, according to the brief from the government union, the American Federation of Government Employees. And I look at all of these numbers. I look at these discussions of how many people are going to be cut, and it's music to my ears. The fact that the head of the Treasury has devised a plan to reduce their workforce by 40%, and that agency will still operate, is an incredibly damning situation that shows what's unfolding in Washington, D.C. When you can look at the Small Business Administration, the SBA, reducing its workforce by 43%, again, not because President Trump said, reduce your workforce by 43%, but he told agency heads, devise a plan to cut out waste, fraud, and abuse, and they have determined that they can cut 43% of their employees and still operate and still provide the core services of the Small Business Administration. How does that not show that there is an incredible amount of waste, fraud, and abuse? If the Department of Health and Human Services can fire 10,000 positions and still operate, what were those people doing there in the first place? What were those individuals doing? Unfortunately, not a whole hell of a lot of anything. Now, some of them may have been, sure. But like many other businesses have to deal with, when the money's tight, when things change, sometimes you have to consolidate. What you might have had two people doing for a long time, maybe it's possible for one person to do it. If the finances, if the money, if the sales aren't there to justify having two people doing that job, you may have to cut one of those individuals, even though they're not a bad employee, even though they're not scamming or gaming the system, and just give that job to one person. Workforce reduction, which is, of course, an unknown foreign concept in the federal or state or local government, happens all the freaking time. I mean, over the last 3 or 4 years since the federal government stopped giving out all of this free COVID money to all of these companies, you've seen it day after day, week after week. Microsoft firing 9,000 employees, Slack firing 3,000 employees, this company firing, 12% of their workforce. Reduction in force happens all the flipping time. It is a normal thing in business. Is it good that it happens? No. But is it absolutely necessary for the continued operation of business? The answer to that question is undoubtedly yes. If businesses do not conduct reduction in force programs, when sales change, when revenue changes, if they don't conduct those reduction in forces, guess what ends up happening? The company goes out of business. They can no longer make payroll. They can no longer make benefit payments. So the option and the alternative is we keep everybody employed for a shorter period of time and then eventually go bankrupt, or we fire people and try and save the company. We fire people, we reduce our workforce, and we try and keep the company financially solvent and financially afloat. Now, if you're faced with those two options, one seems absolutely better than the other. So you can tank and sink the entire company, or you can lay off 5% of your workforce. Right? Let's just look at those two things as options. For those 5% that lose their job, that sucks. For the 5% that are no longer going to have full-time employment, that is a pretty awful situation. I get it. Been there, done that almost a year ago. But the other alternative is the entire company folding because they want to keep more people employed that they can justify paying. It is a completely unsustainable situation long-term. It is something that the federal, state, and local governments across the United States of America are incapable of wrapping their head around, but it is a very real situation that unfolds. It is a very real situation that business has to deal with day in and day out. and this concept, this idea, this notion that it is impossible for the government to scale down its workforce, that it is impossible for the federal government to change who is working at these departments, that they are incapable of changing and reducing any force, is insane. We know for a fact there are tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of federal employees that are not doing anything at their job, not of their own fault, but are not doing anything at their job and collecting a federal paycheck and collecting federal benefits. That is not sustainable. That is not a practical system for the United States under any stretch of the imagination. So with this decision from the United States Supreme Court, that temporary stay, the Supreme Court stopped those lower courts from restricting the President Trump's authority. However, the legal case will go forward to its actual fruition and an actual decision will be made. And at that point, whatever side loses will have the legal authority to appeal. But as it stands right now, these temporary stays, these temporary injunctions put in place to gum up the executive branch, to gum up the work of President Donald Trump, are done. This is another big win for the president, another big win for the administration, and a huge loss to not only what I'll call the deep state, but the federal bureaucracy. Getting some live comments in on our Rumble chat this morning. President Trump is downsizing the federal government. This is what the voters wanted. Can't agree with you anymore. He talked about this, campaigned about this, promises made, promises kept. He signed an executive order less than 20 days after being in office, all to have some left-wing radical district court judge say, nope, you don't have the authority to tell your agency heads to reduce force. What an insane situation, but it is one of many. It is a larger pattern that we have seen with Democrats and their inability to secure power. They will just sue ad nauseum until they get in front of a judge or get in front of a court that rules in their favor. Now, fortunately for Republicans, fortunately for conservatives, the majority on the United States Supreme Court does very handedly tip in our favor. And these things, again, the Supreme Court did not rule on the merits of this case. The Supreme Court did not say that the president is acting lawful or unlawful. What they did say is that this temporary stay is not allowed and that you need to let this legal system and this legal process play out as it should. Enough of the temporary stays, enough of the temporary injunctions. Another major win for President Donald Trump at the Supreme Court. However, the case does go on. We'll track it in the lower courts and see if the left and then these Democrats try any other tricks to stop the president's attempt here to reduce the size, scope, and scale of the federal bureaucracy. Before we continue any more this morning, I want to tell you about the Law Group and thank them for their continued support of the Nick Craig Show. When legal challenges arise, make sure you put your trust in the Law Group right here in Wilmington. Since 2003, their experienced attorneys have provided high-quality, affordable legal services across the eastern half of our state. Whether you're facing a divorce, navigating a real estate transaction, or maybe you're in a position where you need a strong defense, the Law Group has your back. Their dedicated team ensures your questions are answered and issues are resolved promptly. Great news, ladies and gentlemen. They are located in downtown Wilmington and just a phone call away at 910-251-6088, or you can visit them online at lawgroupnc.com. That's 910-251-6088, or their website, lawgroupnc.com. The Law Group, experience and dedication you can rely on. We appreciate the Law Group and their continued support of the Nick Craig Show. If you've got any legal questions throughout southeastern North Carolina, can highly recommend and highly encourage you to reach out to the good folks over at the Law Group. Give them a call, 910-251-6088. We've got a lot more on this Wednesday edition of the Nick Craig Show. We'll grab a quick break. Thanks for joining us live this morning on YouTube, Rumble, and X, and 24/7, wherever you get your podcasts. And a good Wednesday morning to you. Welcome back to the Nick Craig Show, streaming live this morning on YouTube, Rumble, and X. Don't forget that if you are enjoying the show and want to support it financially, you can do so by visiting patreon.com/Nick Craig. $5, $10 a month if you believe that you are getting some value from the show. You'll get access to a daily show notes, all of the articles and stories that we talk about, plus our monthly hangout. All of that is available over at patreon.com/Nick Craig. Got a great group on there. Very much appreciate their support and continuing the operation here of the Nick Craig Show. All right, well, on to what has been a very big political story over the last couple of days. This discussion and this decision from the FBI and the DOJ on the Jeffrey Epstein case. So we were told very early on in the Trump administration, and I think it's important to lay this out. We were told in the very early days by Lena Habba, Pam Bondi, Trump himself, a whole bunch of other people, that there were client lists, that there were flight logs, documents, all of this evidence and information that the federal government has been hiding and has been covering up. And we've got it. It's on Pam Bondi's desk. We're ready to release this to the American people. All for this to culminate over the last couple of days with the DOJ saying, yeah, the case is closed. Dan Bongino and Kash Patel saying, yeah, there's no evidence of any foul play of Jeffrey Epstein's alleged hanging of himself in a prison in New York or New Jersey, one of the two. Just nothing. It's just all said and done. And this has been brewing very heavily in right-wing circles over the last couple of days because we were told that all of this stuff was there. I mean, months ago, Pam Bondi, it's on Pam Bondi's desk. It's ready to be released. And so the reason I bring up that pretext, and I'm going to be honest with you, I don't really care about the whole Jeffrey Epstein thing. I mean, it's said and done. It's not something that I derive my political ideology from. But when the setup is there, when the White House and the administration invites all of these social media influencers to the White House and gives them this big, big binder that says the Epstein files, and there's frankly just jack shit inside of it, and then we're told that, oh, there's actually no client lists, actually there's no video surveillance, actually there's no other information to provide, they set themselves up for failure, and they have rightfully so set themselves up for an incredible amount of criticism from those on the right. Not because I believe that this whole Jeffrey Epstein thing is the biggest story in the world, and I mean, honestly, client lists and all that stuff, it's not going to change anything. Nobody's going to be prosecuted. I don't think any of that's going to happen. But why did this administration make such a big deal out of it in the early days if it was really just nothing? Why did this administration continually gaslight the base and the American voters that there was going to be some bombshell story that was going to be released, some bombshell documents as part of the Epstein files, and now we're told there's nothing? President Donald Trump is pissed about this situation. He was asked after the cabinet meeting yesterday about the Epstein files. He teed off on a reporter. This is a really bad look for President Trump.
Sure. Your memo and release yesterday on Jeffrey Epstein, yes, it left some lingering mysteries. One of the biggest ones is whether he ever worked for a American or foreign intelligence agency. The former labor secretary, who was Miami U.S. attorney, Alex Acosta, he allegedly said that he did work for an intelligence agency. So could you resolve whether or not he did? And also, could you say why there was a minute missing from the jailhouse tape on the night of his death?
Are you still talking about Jeffrey Epstein? This guy's been talked about for years. You're asking, we have Texas, we have this, we have all of the things. Yeah. And are people still talking about this guy, yeah, this creep? That is unbelievable. Do you want to waste the time and do you feel like answering?
I don't mind answering.
I mean, I can't believe you're asking a question on Epstein at a time like this where we're having some of the greatest success and also tragedy with what happened in Texas. It just seems like a desecration, but you go ahead.
Sure. First, to back up on that, in February, I did an interview on Fox, and it's been getting a lot of attention because I said, I was asked a question about the client list, and my response was, it's sitting on my desk to be reviewed, meaning the file along with the JFK, MLK files as well. That's what I meant by that. Also, to the tens of thousands of video, They turned out to be child porn downloaded by that disgusting Jeffrey Epstein. Child porn is what they were. Never going to be released, never going to see the light of day. To him being an agent, I have no knowledge about that. We can get back to you on that. And the minute missing from the video, we released the video showing definitively the video was not conclusive, but the evidence prior to it was showing he committed suicide. And what was on that, there was a minute that was off the counter. And what we learned from Bureau of Prisons was every year, every night, they redo that video. It's old, from like 1999. So every night the video is reset, and every night should have the same minute missing. So we're looking for that video to release that as well, showing that a minute is missing every night. And that's it on Epstein.
Just again, do I think that the do I care about the Jeffrey Epstein thing at this point? No. I mean, I will agree with the president that at this point it's long said and done. What I will not agree with the president, what he is rightfully so receiving an incredible amount of backlash from his base on, is the fact that Trump needs to understand that if they feel like they are being misled or lied to, which I would argue is what you just saw, right? Trump goes, we're not going to talk about that. We've got flooding in Texas and we're dealing with great successes, so we're just not going to talk about it. That is a typical Democrat government answer to a problem, or to a question, I should say. When the government doesn't want to deal with something, they gaslight and they deflect to what else is going on. And to me, that is not a sufficient answer from President Donald Trump. That is not a sufficient answer. Does the president make a good point about why are we still talking about it? Sure. But again, the administration set this whole thing in motion over the last couple of months. They invited a whole bunch of social media influencers to the White House and gave them binders with no useful information and some big photo op of Jack Posobiec and Mark Cernovich and a bunch of other individuals walking out with this white binder that says the Epstein files. What the hell was the whole point of that? If there's nothing new, if there's no information, this is the reason he is catching so much flack is not because not necessarily because I believe that everybody is still so fixated and fascinated with Jeffrey Epstein. It's blatantly obvious that the guy didn't kill himself. Let's be perfectly clear and honest, regardless of what Dan Bongino or Kash Patel say. It's very, very obvious. But he's pissed off and frustrated that the base is pissed off and frustrated that they continued to bring it up, meaning the administration. They continued to bring it up. They continued to talk about it. They turned it into a photo op on more than one occasion and now tell the American people there's nothing there. There's nothing to see. And there's no other information that's going to be provided. That's, I think, why people are so pissed off. And rightfully so. Because is there likely some significant information that the either Jeffrey Epstein was some sort of agent for the CIA or one of these other three-letter agencies? Is there individuals on the client list that we haven't been told about? There's probably some pretty damning information in there. It's just my gut reaction. And the fact that now the administration is trying to hide this, the fact now that the administration is trying to play it off as there's bigger issues going on, there's more important issues to deal with, stop talking about this. We don't support that. The reason, and I'll speak for myself here, one of the reasons I voted for President Donald Trump is because I was under the impression, and still am, under the impression that this status quo government standard of, oh, don't look over here, look at this other shiny object, which has been very standard in government for decades now, that was going away. That the federal government would no longer partake in lying to the American people and gaslighting the American people on things that they genuinely and rightfully so have serious questions and doubt about, like the fact that Jeffrey Epstein hung himself in a prison. There's no video of it, and hung himself with bed sheets that are as strong as a piece of tissue paper. Somehow was able to wrap that around his neck and around his bed and hang himself. Seems incredibly suspicious. And so I've held off on talking about this for a couple of days because I didn't really know how it was going to play out. But based on Trump's reaction yesterday, I would say it is obvious that we're not going to get any other information. The president is obviously was pissed off that the question was asked. And I have seen, you know, there's an incredible amount of individuals on the right, a lot, and I would say the vast majority of those on the right that have that are finding themselves incredibly critical of the administration over this discussion, over what has gone on in this process that they have watched unfold over the last 6 months. Jeffrey Epstein was a disgusting, despicable human being. There's no argument about that. And, you know, to Elon Musk's credit, he, we've been relatively critical of Elon Musk over the last couple of days, but he put this post out on his X yesterday. How can people be expected to have faith in Trump if we won't release the Epstein files? I think that's where a lot of folks probably stand this morning, right? We do want to have faith in Donald Trump. We do want to have faith in individuals like Pam Bondi and the rest of those in the administration. And when we're told that there's truly nothing there, which I think is complete and total nonsense, but when we're told that there's nothing there and that we need to stop asking about it, that is only going to cause more criticism. That is only going to cause more questions to be asked, and it's only going to cause more skepticism of the entire thing. I mean, the Streisand effect in full force with this situation. Now, why are these files not being released? I have absolutely no idea. What's in there? I don't know. Why is the president hiding them? I have no idea. But this answer yesterday after the, or right before the cabinet meeting, is not going to be sufficient. I can promise you that the response given by Trump yesterday is not going to be, and evidence is played out very well on social media, that his base is not in favor, that his base is still incredibly critical of the situation, that his base is saying, we want more answers. We want more of this to be answered, and we want some of these questions to come out into the light. Now, some comments have been brought up that, oh, well, the reason that Trump is not releasing this is because the Jeffrey Epstein list implicates himself. It's an interesting concept. It's an interesting idea. However, as being pointed out in our Rumble chat this morning, if Trump was on the list, which of course Elon Musk claimed about 6 weeks ago, that information would already be out there. If Donald Trump was implicated in the Jeffrey Epstein files, you can absolutely guarantee without a shadow of a doubt that the federal government under the Biden administration would have leaked that information. That information would have already been public. So I don't really, and I can't really buy into that being the case. I just don't. So why is it not being released? There is a slim, and I mean very slim, possibility that there's truly nothing to be seen there. That maybe the deep state in the past has already destroyed some of this evidence and it's no longer there. I guess there's a possibility that that's what has gone on. But to me, it just seems incredibly, incredibly unlikely. So you've got Pam Bondi saying that the Epstein case is closed. You've got Kash Patel and Dan Bongino, who Bongino was incredibly critical of the Epstein stuff. You've got them saying, yep, there are no questions asked. Case closed. He definitely killed himself. Something just smells funky. Something, it just doesn't pass the smell test. I would imagine that this controversy and criticism is going to go on for the next little bit. But if the administration holds to this line and says, hey, there's nothing there, why are we talking about it? The situation's probably just going to go by the wayside. I mean, that's the reality of what is likely to happen here as a result of what you saw. Again, Trump seemed very pissed off about being asked this question yesterday. So he obviously wants this story to go away. The question is, does his base, do his supporters feel the same way? And as it would seem right now, based on some of the social media commentary and those, some of those that were, by the way, part of that photo op with the Epstein binder. I saw Jack Posobiec yesterday on X saying, this is just insane. So that's the latest on the Epstein files. As it seems right now, not a whole hell of a lot of information expected to come out. We'll just wait and see. Maybe Trump has a change of heart. Maybe the pressure is too great. Maybe some of his closer advisors start picking up on some of this this social media commentary and some of this other chatter and determine that, we've got to actually provide the American people with some answers here. If not, I do believe that there's some that will lose trust in the administration, and he's going to have to work hard to get that back. So we'll continue to wait, watch, and see. And see exactly what goes on with this situation. So that's going to do it for a Wednesday edition of the Nick Craig Show. Thanks to the Law Group for their continued support. Give them a call or visit them online, 910-251-6088, or visit their website, lawgroupnc.com. Tomorrow morning, Chinese farmland, a big discussion across the United States and North Carolina. We'll have all the details live, 7 a.m. on YouTube, Rumble, and X, and 24/7, wherever you get your podcasts.